embarked on a new solo adventure after spending months under the care of conservationists. Four-month-old Evie was released back into the wild on February 15th in northern Greece. Evie was rescued when she was only 7 days old. She had been washed ashore and separated from her nursing mother during a storm. However, conservationists found the lucky seal and started taking care of her. Even though Evie's health was poor, she recuperated quickly.
She was really dehydrated in the beginning, which is very common with pups that separate from their mothers at such an early age. And the first few weeks were critical for her health because there's basically no way to replenish, like to replace the mother's milk. So we have a certain protocol and a food regimen that we provide along with vitamins and other supplements to the seal. And thankfully, in the first few weeks, she showed signs of her health status became better.
The conservationists hope Evie will be able to join a community of her species soon. They will be tracking her movements with a chip. There are only a few hundred Mediterranean monk seals left in the wild. About half of them live in Greece. Entrapment from fishing, pollution, depletion of food resources, and climate change are some of the threats facing the species.
History shows a gun barrel never stops people from acquiring their learning tools. A bookshop in the besieged Gaza Strip is a testimony as book lovers flooded the store months after it was flattened in an Israeli airstrike. The new Samir Mansour bookshop, funded by an international donor campaign, now stands some 200 meters from its original site. It was destroyed by an Israeli airstrike on the west of Gaza City last year. The new shop is spread across two floors and is stocked with some 400,000 books. They range from school texts to the Quran to Arabic translations of European literary classics. Hundreds of people, including writers and Palestinian officials, attended the bookshop's reopening. The store first opened its doors 30 years ago and is considered the oldest and the biggest in Gaza.
The City of London usually welcomes arts and culture from all over the world, including Iran. In our next report, Bianca Rahimi will be taking us to a performance that fuses music from across the East.
A dream has become a reality. The Conference of the Birds, composed by the brilliant young musician Mehsan Marvasti and inspired by a poem of the same name written by poet Attar of Nishapur in the 12th century, performed here in London. It's a story all Iranians are familiar with, about an epic journey to find the Simurgh.
The Simurgh is to the east what the phoenix is to the west, a mythical creature that symbolizes transformation. And the story of the Simurgh is a spiritual one, full of courage, determination, and self-discovery.
Well, I think it's the first time I've seen so prominently advertised a non-Western musical traditional concert. And I've got a long-standing interest in music from the different parts of the Islamic world. It kind of evokes sort of deeper feelings, spiritual feelings. And the fact that this specific concert is about kind of a spiritual poem, it taps into something which I think a lot of us are looking for, especially in this post-pandemic, current pandemic situation. We're looking for some deeper meanings. So I think it will be striking a chord for a lot of people.
It's a mix, a fusion of different music, and that's always interesting. And it's Eurasian music, and it uses different instruments from across Asia to represent birds, and it just sounded lovely.
Even though there are differences, cultural differences, between these places and these peoples, and those differences should be recognised in general, that through things like music and art, there can also be synergy and, like, yeah, things can work together as well.
5 years in the making, the Conference of the Birds, conducted by Farnoush Behzad, brought together musicians and instruments from across the world. It fuses Azeri, Chinese, Indian, Arabic, Afghan, Armenian and Persian music, brought to the audience by a Western orchestra. The performance was accompanied by two elocutionists who narrated the story and animated clips of birds and their migratory lives. The art and culture of Iran needs no introduction, renowned worldwide. But young Iranian artists living far from home are always looking for ways to capture the spirit of their homeland and offer Western audiences a taste of Iran. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the absolutely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَيَوْمَ يَعَضُّ الظَّالِمُ عَلَى يَدَيْهِ يَقُولُ يَا لَيْتَنِي اتَّخَذْتُ مَعَ الرَّسُولِ سَبِيلًا
And the day when the wrongdoer will bite at his hands, he will say, Oh, would that I had taken a path with the messenger.
يَا وَيْلَتَى لَيْتَنِي لَمْ أَتَّخِذْ فُلَانًا خَلِيلًا
Ah, woe to me, would that I had never taken so-and-so as a friend.
لَقَدْ أَضَلَّنِي عَنِ الذِّكْرِ بَعْدَ إِذْ جَاءَنِي وَكَانَ الشَّيْطَانُ لِلْإِنسَانِ خَذُولًا
He indeed led me astray from the reminder after it had come to me, and Satan is ever a deserter to man in the hour of need.
Brothers and sisters, previously we started discussing the 27th to 29th verse of this chapter. In the previous program, by having a look at some of the traditions in our books, we had a quick look at the role of friend in man's destiny. We said that from the viewpoint of Islam, this impressionability that exists in human beings is really logical, and that's why we have so many narrations introducing us the different criteria that we should take into consideration while selecting a friend. In this regard, Imam Ali alayhi salam has said, A man's friend is the sign of his intellect, and his speech is the sign of his virtue. Looking at this beautiful word of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we understand that one of the ways you can understand whether someone is wise or not is choosing his friends. And this choosing friend can also impact his virtue, because it is sometimes the friends that we are using as our teachers in the way we speak. The Holy Prophet of Islam, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, has said, "The happiest man is the one who associates with respected and dignified people. Although they must be dignified, we already know that we should not befriend the people, the wealthy ones, who are indulging in luxury."
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qum.
Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has said, "The most favored brothers of mine are those who present me with my defects and to warn me of my defects." Sometimes we may think that the ones who are always complimenting us, they are the ones who we should befriend. But this is not what Imam Sadiq alayhi salam introduces as the criterion. In fact, selecting a friend is so important that we have some traditions introducing the best friends. For example, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "The best friends of yours is the one who makes you fond of the hereafter. And the best friend of yours is the one who makes you indifferent to this world and helps you in obeying Almighty Allah." Elsewhere, the Prophet of Islam sallallahu alaihi wasallam was once asked about the best companion. He said, "The best friend is the one whose meeting reminds Allah to you, is the one whose words increases your knowledge, and the best friend is the one whose behavior makes you remember the hereafter." So you see, dear listeners, Islam has got many pieces of advice about friendship, about selecting a friend. Islam encourages having friendship with some people and prohibits friendship of some others. And this needs a special separate discussion. This is so important that there are different subtitles in this regard. The ways of knowing a friend, the boundaries of friendship, continuity of friendship, and sometimes termination of friendship are mentioned in our traditions. In the words of Ahlul Bayt, we see how motivations of friendship must be. We see some rules of association with friends and rights of friends. And for each of these subtitles, there are lots of verses and narrations. Also, Imam Ali alayhi salam has said, good friend is the best relative. There is a tradition that says, test your friend with money, anger, wealth, and journey. If he is successful in all these aspects, then he's a good one. So all these subtitles we have in our traditions, but of course they need special separate discussions, maybe in another version of the program. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stand here so unafraid of everything around me. Proudly I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam dini wal azam ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to be talking about the prayer rules according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Well, the topic is the rules of prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And Sheikh Javid, let me ask you this question about doubts. An important question about the prayer concerns the doubts that we may entertain during prayers, right? Mm-hmm. However, many kinds of doubts are there. And what are the doubts that make the prayers void?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There are many doubts, at least 22 doubts mentioned in the Risala or the Islamic laws written by the religious authorities, including Grand Ayatollah Khamenei. Of course, out of these 22 doubts, 7 doubts are those which invalidate the prayers, and 6 are those which should be ignored by us. And the remaining 9 doubts are valid doubts. And it's very important for believers, for mu'mineen, to understand and to learn the doubts during prayer. Because if you know how to act while encountering a doubt, I think it will be easier for you to finish your prayer and not to be not to repeat the prayer from the beginning.
Yes,
you know, if you know the rules of the doubts and deliberately ignore the rules and mm-hmm. start offering your prayers all over again.
Yes,
then it means that you are not following the rules. Allah, the Almighty, and of course the religion of Islam have prescribed certain things to be followed, and that the procedure has to be understood and to be practiced by us. And Islam does not want to impose something very difficult on us, because if you have finished the prayer, and if you follow the rules of doubt, maybe you will not need to repeat the prayer, or maybe you can ignore the prayer, mm-hmm. or the doubt might be valid. But if you keep entertaining the doubt and keep standing, having the doubt. Because of the doubt, if you start your prayer all over again, it means that you are unnecessarily making it very difficult for yourselves.
Exactly.
So when it comes to the doubts which make the prayer void, of course, I would like to mention those seven doubts, of course. The first one is doubts about the number of rakahs occurring in obligatory prayers, which consist of two rakahs. We know that, for example, we offer Fajr prayer, and the Fajr prayer, it consists of two rakahs.
Yes.
And if you doubt about the number of this rakah, the Fajr prayer, the prayer becomes void. If you doubt between two and three rakahs, or if you doubt between one and two rakahs, of course, the prayer concerning the number of the rakats of the Fajr prayer becomes void. The doubt makes the prayer void.
For the morning,
this is the first one. The second one is doubts about the number of rakats occurring in prayers consisting of three rakats. Now we have Fajr Maghrib prayer, which consists of three rakats. If you doubt between two and three rakats, or if you doubt between three and four rakats, of course, the prayer becomes void.
Void.
And then we have doubt occurring in prayers consisting of four rakats as to whether you have, for example, performed one rakat or more rakat. If you doubt between one rakat or, let's say, four rakat, one rakat and five rakat, one rakat and you see, and two rakat, of course, and the prayer.
If the element or number one is included,
one
in
is included.
Any prayer.
One plus any other rakat, then the prayer becomes void.
Void.
And then number four.
Okay, let me stop you there.
Okay.
Before you talk about the fourth, in fact, doubt, for a very short break, and we'll be back. Don't go away.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Jawid, our dear guest speaker. The topic we are talking about is doubts during the prayer. Well, before the break, Sheikh Jawid, you, in fact, gave us three of those doubts which invalidates the prayer, right?
Yeah.
And what about the fourth one? Would you continue, please?
Yeah. The fourth doubt is the doubt in prayer of four rakats, in prayer that consists of four rakats. And that doubt may arise when you complete the second sajda, okay? The second sajda as to whether you have performed two rakats or more. Before completing the second sajda, you doubt whether you have, you just keep doubting whether you have done two rakats or more, and you do not know, and you cannot come to a conclusion about the number of the rakats, because we are supposed to wait a little bit. Do not we are supposed not to rush.
Yes,
wait for a few seconds and think whether we have, for example, done at least two rakats or three rakats or four. But if we still remain in the same position, not getting inclined to one side of the doubt.
Yes,
then we. And the prayer becomes void.
I see.
Then there is the fifth one. Doubt between two rakats and five rakats. Two rakats and five rakats, of course. Or between two rakats and more than five rakats. More than. You might
not want, two and three, not two and four.
Yeah.
Not it's two and five.
Yeah, two and five and two and more than five. Okay?
I see.
Of course, if you... Such things might happen very rarely.
Yes,
and very
of course.
Few people might doubt between two or three. But this is just a scenario. The scenario. And in this scenario, in this situation, one is supposed to consider his prayer void if such a thing happens.
Yes.
And then we have the sixth one, doubt between three rakats and six rakats.
Mm-hmm.
Three rakats and six rakats. Or between three and more than six rakats. the prayer becomes white. Okay? And then we have doubt between four rakats and six rakats, or between four rakats and more than six rakats.
Not four and five.
Not four and five. Because the position about four and five is clear, okay? Mm-hmm. If you doubt between four rakats and five rakats, of course, you are supposed to assume that you have offered four rakats, and then you are going to perform one sajda, two sajda of sahab, okay?
Yes,
you are exactly supposed to perform sajda sahab. But here the doubt persists between four and you know, and six rakat and four and more than six rakats. And in that case, of course, the prayer becomes white. These are the seven doubts which make the prayer invalid.
Okay, we have only about 1 minute, Sheikh Javid.
Yes.
Let's talk about those doubts that can be or should be ignored. Would you talk about them too, please?
That's also a very good question. And I really want my brothers and sisters who are listening to us to learn these doubts, because these are very much practical and we encounter these doubts on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
But there's one thing I would like to ask my brothers and sisters. If they are people who frequently are doubt and who are doubting very often.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you doubt three times in one prayer, or if you doubt three times in three consecutive prayers, then such a person is deemed and labeled as and considered as kasirush shak. Now, such a person should ignore
a constant
his doubt.
Doubter.
Yeah, a frequent doubter.
Yeah, frequent doubter.
That's a good help from you. Now, I would like to say that the doubts which must be ignored by an individual while doubting. Doubt about an act whose time of performance has already passed. Now, you are, for example, you doubt whether you have done ruku or not while you are doing sujood, okay? You're doing. Have I done ruku or not? Have I recited the zikr of hamd in surah or not? Then, because the time has already passed, you have gone to moved into the next rukun.
Yes.
You should ignore your doubt, and your doubt must be ignored in this case.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Since the time of the program has come to an end, we promise our dear audience to talk about more of these doubts in the upcoming session, inshallah.
Sure.
Hopefully speaking. Well, thank you very much, dear audience, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me and the rest of the crew, we leave you in Allah's care.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello and welcome to the latest installment of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. I'm your host, Robert Carter. This week, we'll examine the Zionist-led attack on higher education in the UK and beyond. We'll focus on the attempt to remove voices critical of settler colonialism in British universities, and on one key occasion that has done more than many to harass and intimidate universities, the Community Security Trust. As always, we'll be joined by expert guests to delve into the background of Israel's ethnic cleansing and explore what can be done about it. But first, Bianca Rahimi gets us started with this special report on the innocent-sounding Community Security Trust.
Why are academics from the United States to Britain being chased out of their jobs for standing with the Palestinians? From Stephen Salater to Cornel West, outspoken and high-profile university lecturers shunned from their positions are bitterly complaining about the influence of the Israel lobby. One of the most notable scalps claimed in Britain was our own resident expert, Professor David Miller of the University of Bristol, who was sacked in October 2021. But where did the bid to oust him come from? The years-long smear campaign against David Miller began with a UK charity named the Community Security Trust. But what is the CST and who exactly is behind it? The Community Security Trust was created in 1994 and its explicit aim is to campaign against anti-Semitism. Based in North London, critics have long charged that it deliberately blurs the distinction between anti-Semitism and criticism of Israel. The CST is run by the convicted fraudster and supporter of Netanyahu, Gerald Ronson. At the time of its founding, Ronson was a board member of the Israel lobby group, BICOM. So close to the Israeli government is Ronson that when serving jail time for fraud, he was phoned by serving Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. Ronson and two other founding trustees of the CST were central to the United Jewish Israel Appeal, a UK fundraising vehicle described as one of Israel's national institutions. His charity of the Gerald and Gail Ronson Family Foundation has pledged over £4 million to the Jerusalem Foundation, which builds for settlers in East Jerusalem. A scanning of Ronson's memoirs reveals he prides himself on being good with his fists and holds Islamophobic views. Today, the CST works hard to give a more civilized impression. The Community Security Trust is lavished with funding by the British government. In 2012, Education Secretary Michael Gove allocated £2 million of public money to the CST, despite simultaneously sitting on the organization's advisory board. In fact, the CST receives millions in funding from the government every year. In April 2020, the Home Office gave the CST £40 million. The Home Secretary at the time was Priti Patel, who had famously had to resign in 2017 over unauthorized secret meetings with Israeli officials about directing public funds to the Zionist entity. While the CST claims it does not lobby for the Israeli regime, the evidence begs to differ, as the usurping entity fostered the idea of anti-Zionism as a new anti-Semitism. The CST has echoed that call consistently. According to Anthony Lerman, the director of the Institute of Jewish Policy Research, who previously worked very closely with the CST, Israel's external intelligence oversaw the regime's campaigns against anti-Semitism in the early 2000s. Lerman also asserts that CST staff have been trained by Israeli intelligence. One of the long-running criticisms of the organization has been that despite claims it protects the Jewish community, it actually targets some Jews as a threat. Left-wing Jews and those critical of Israel have been forcibly removed from meetings. One of the CST activities seems to be the creating of extensive files on critics of Israel. It was exposed that the CST submitted to the British Home Office a list of anti-Zionist Jews that it defined as extremists. The CST were also involved in working for a change in the law on universal jurisdiction, which protects war criminals of the Israeli regime from UK arrest. The organization was also on the executive committee of the Fair Play Campaign Group, a joint anti-BDS initiative of several Israel lobby groups. From 2003, the CST with other pro-Israel groups advised the Israeli regime's Coordination Forum for Monitoring Anti-Semitism. This produced a concerted effort to lobby for a definition of anti-Semitism that would assist them in censoring and then attempting to criminalize anti-Zionism and criticism of Israel more generally. This process ended with the adoption in 2016 of the International Holocaust Remembrance Association Working Definition of Anti-Semitism, a definition which prohibits identification of the racist nature of Zionism. This is the weapon of choice now being deployed against universities. The CST was behind the original complaint against Professor Miller at the University of Bristol. When that was rebuffed, the CST approached the Union of Jewish Students, with which it had a very close relationship, and the UJS put in a complaint as a result. The avalanche against David Miller consisted of parliamentarians and even a direct intervention serving housing minister with links to Israeli intelligence, Robert Jenrick. Despite being cleared by a Bristol University investigation of any form of anti-Semitism, David Miller was fired as the university administration crumbled under the pressure. As the victims of this witch hunt struggle to repair their lives and fight for their livelihoods, the question must be asked, why is an organization founded by a lobbyist for a foreign regime with staff trained by a foreign intelligence service being funded by the British taxpayer? And why is it attempting to dictate who can and who can't teach in British universities?
To discuss the Community Security Trust and the forces behind it, we're joined today by two guests. Chris Williamson is the former Labour MP for Derby North and a well-known campaigner for socialism and Palestinian rights. Chris was a Shadow Communities and Home Office Minister under Ed Miliband and Jeremy Corbyn. But since leaving Parliament in 2019, Chris has founded the Resist Movement for a People's Party and established the Left Legal Fighting Fund. He's also joined by our regular programme expert, David Miller, who is an academic and former professor at Bristol University and co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative, Spinwatch. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. Now, David, I'm going to start off with you because this is obviously quite personal for you. The CST were, of course, involved, as we've heard from Bianca, in your case regarding your job at Bristol University. Could you just tell us a little bit about what that was like and what they were up to in the whole affair?
Well, I'd been at Bristol University for only a few months when I did a lecture on Islamophobia, in which I discussed my writing on Islamophobia, in particular the role of the Zionist movement, parts of the Zionist movement, in encouraging Islamophobia. And the CST complained about the lecture to the university and said that I was defaming the CST and that what I was saying was quite wrong. The university rejected the complaint because the CST doesn't have any basis to make complaints. You have to be a student to make a complaint. And they couldn't get any students to complain about me, so they approached the Union of Jewish Students and they had them put in a complaint, and they recruited for that the head of the Jewish Society at Bristol to do that. Now, these complaints were eventually rejected, but there was a two-year campaign following this by the CST, by the UJS, and by a whole range of Israel lobby groups, far too many to mention, who consistently argued for me to be sacked. And that culminated in the end in a second investigation of me in February 2021, which eventually resulted in me being sacked in October 21. So there was a long period, almost 3 years, of a concerted attack on me. And the interesting thing about the CST's role here is it goes back a lot further than that 2 to 3 year campaign to my first interactions with the CST when I was an expert witness called for the defence of a Palestinian politician called Sheikh Raed Salah, who was being deported. The Home Office were trying to deport him. And they were trying to deport him based on evidence the CST had provided to the Home Office. And in the course of the proceedings, we got to see this evidence. And amongst other misinformation in there, the CST had provided to the Home Office a translation of a poem by Salah in which the word oppressors had been mistranslated to Jews. And so you could see that there was a process there of misinformation which comes from the files that the CST maintains. It's in part a spy agency. And when I was involved in that case, I revealed what the CST was up to, and they lost the case, and Sheikh Salah was not deported. And so ever since then, this is back in 2011, they've had an animus against me, and they didn't forget that.
Now, Chris, you were obviously involved in your own dispute within the Labour Party regarding the anti-Semitism scandals and so on, the witch hunt, as it's been described by you and some of your allies, if you like. How did the CST play a role in all that?
Well, the CST and the UGS actually had a really pernicious influence, I think, on the Labour Party and led the witch hunt. I mean, I was smeared on a relatively regular basis, both by the CST, a so-called charity, and the Union of Jewish Students as well. And there was an organised campaign to no-platform me at universities. Various university bodies, as a result of lobbying by the UGS, and no doubt having reference as well to the CST, were then actually joining in the smear. So there was a kind of real momentum built up. behind the attacks that were being levelled against me by the CST and the UGS. And that was essentially because I was, speaking up for Palestinian rights and ironically defending anti-Zionist left-wing Jewish comrades who had been suspended from the Labour Party.
Now, David, obviously Michael Gove's relationship with the CST as well is indicative of the wider embrace of pro-Israel organisations by politicians. Perhaps you could go into that, because Michael Gove isn't the only politician that's linked to the CST and their activities.
Well, one of the things that I discovered in doing this research back in 2011 on the CST was their secret list of advisors, which they don't publicise. I was able to find this online. They had it had been put online inadvertently, and I was able to find this. And amongst the advisors was Michael Gove, but many other politicians on there as well, and indeed many former and current senior police officers on there too. And we were able to point out then that when Michael Gove gave millions of pounds to the CST, that he had a conflict of interest, which should have meant that he had excluded himself from the decision-making process. The Home Office didn't seem to mind about that. But Gove is a very interesting character. He is, of course, I suppose, one of the best-known neoconservatives in this country. He is ferociously pro-Israel. That's one of the people at the heart of government who have been very key in promoting the interests of lobby groups like the CST. There are others too. I mean, they, as it was mentioned in the film, Priti Patel, was had to resign over secret meetings with the Israelis, including meetings in the occupied Golan Heights, where she was talking about the need to send UK aid money, not to the Palestinians, but to the IDF for their activities in the Golan Heights. Truly extraordinary thing to say. So, yeah, of course, there are many politicians who have the ear of the Israel lobby and who will do their bidding.
And I think what's also interesting is a lot of these politicians, Michael Gove, Priti Patel, they've also been accused of Islamophobia. Michael Gove has actually written some texts regarding his views on Islam, which are considered Islamophobic, to say the least. And they also coincidentally are pro-Israel in the same right. But before we go on to that, let me ask you about this group's link to Bristol University, because I believe you have something to say on that as well.
Well, I mean, the CST complained in March 2019, but it's since come to light that the Gail and Gerald Ronson Family Foundation, which is run by the head of the CST, Gerald Ronson, gave money to the University of Bristol in 2011, 2017, 2018. And as a result, the foundation became part of the Vice-Chancellor's Circle, which is a kind of elite, exclusive club for people to engage with the Vice-Chancellor. Now, we have no evidence that there was any direct relationship between this funding and the pressure to sack me, but it certainly is the case that that there were many people who give funding to the university who called for me to be sacked. I'm aware of this from the internal evidence that there isn't on the matter. So it's an issue, I think, that which could be looked at, but which has not been previously discussed by anyone or noticed, indeed, by anyone.
Now, Chris, David Miller is an academic, one of many that's been targeted by groups like the CST. You're of a politician background, political background. You as well have claimed that the CST, among others, have gone after you. Another politician that has been gone after in a very similar way is Jeremy Corbyn, mm-hmm. very well known internationally, mm-hmm. The former leader of the Labour Party. Has the CST played any role against him? And if so, could you just elaborate on what they've been up to?
Yes, they have. And I think Jeremy's response and the leadership in general's response, leadership of the Labour Party's response to these accusations actually fed them and made matters worse, because Jeremy continued to, backtrack and to apologise for nothing, frankly. I had nothing to apologise about. Jeremy's record on fighting bigotry and racism is, second to none. But the problem was that the default position was that whenever there was an accusation of anti-Semitism, the Labour Party backed down, capitulated, and the unit that was charged, the so-called governance and legal unit, with, administering the disciplinary process in the Labour Party, they had a special unit dealing with anti-Semitism, and the go-to source for information about anti-Semitism was the CST, in particular, Dave Rich, who is the head of policy at the CST. And they obviously conflate anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism. The Labour Party adopted the IHRA working definition, and all these things coming together resulted in a situation where people were being systematically thrown under the bus. Jeremy Corbyn's strongest supporters, basically, you know, left-wing, anti-racist, pro-Palestinian socialists, were being thrown under the bus on a systematic basis. And the you know, the real problem was that people, as I say, charged with dealing with disciplinary matters inside the Labour Party, were looking to a body which has clearly made that conflation. And even the General Secretary, they were besotted by the CST. And little wonder, therefore, we ended up in a situation where ultimately, you know, the Labour Party and that whole move, that whole so-called Corbyn project, that drive towards a transformational socialist programme in the country, was consumed by this. And that, in no small measure, a lot of people have said Labour lost the election in 2019 because of Brexit. That was obviously a factor. But another one that hasn't got, I think, the attention that it deserves is this capitulation to false anti-Semitism slurs. What the leadership should have done, what the party should have done, is to stand up to them and talk about Jeremy's record, talk about the Labour Party record, talk about the people that were being targeted, particularly, as I say, left-wing Jews. I mean, some of the people that were targeted were the children of Holocaust survivors, the children of Auschwitz, people, their parents had survived Auschwitz. It was an absolute scandal, a disgrace, and it destroyed Jeremy Corbyn, it destroyed the Corbyn project, and I believe led directly to the election of a right-wing government of Boris Johnson.
And Chris, I want to ask you about this point as well. It was mentioned in part in Bianca's report earlier in the show. The CST claim that they're about fighting anti-Semitism wherever it is, raising alarm bells. But right now in the Labour Party, it's actually left-wing socialist Jewish members which are being kicked out, booted out, accused of being anti-Semitic, if I'm not mistaken. Perhaps you could elaborate that point.
Yes, indeed. I mean, that gives a lie to the assertion by the CST that they're concerned about anti-Semitism. The reality is they're concerned about people exposing, calling out Zionism. Because what we're now seeing is, as you say, left-wing Jewish members of the Labour Party are being thrown out on a systematic basis. And indeed, an organisation called the Jewish Voice for Labour has done some number crunching. And they have worked out that if you're a member of the JVL, I think you're 4 or 5 times more likely to be expelled or suspended from the Labour Party. If you're a committee member of the Jewish Voice for Labour, I think they worked out there's something like 150 or 200 times more likely to be disciplined, suspended and expelled from the Labour Party. It's an absolute disgrace. It's a travesty, frankly, a travesty of justice. And, you know, it's... I think that the way in which the party, the leadership of the party, capitulated to these false slurs has opened the floodgates. It's led directly to people like esteemed academics, like Professor David Miller here, being targeted, and others are being targeted as well. And that's why I think, you know, there could be no compromise, in my opinion, and this is what I was arguing for inside the Labour Party at the time, and pleading with Jeremy and socialist members of the Parliamentary Labour Party to draw a line in the sand and to fight back and speak up for Jeremy's reputation, for the party's reputation, for their own reputation, because they were also being demonised by these despicable slurs which are being levelled against people who spent their life fighting racism.
And David, you're of course one of those individuals who did draw a line in the sand. You continued to talk about Israel and crimes against the Palestinians, the issues with Zionism and the Israel lobby and its activities in the UK and elsewhere. And of course you've been persecuted for that, as you've put it in your own words in the past. But surely you've mentioned this to the university at the time when they were investigating and so on. And there are many other groups which have mentioned and complained about this type of issue, issues with groups like the CST and so on. What was the university's response? Because surely they were being told, look, don't trust what groups like the CST are telling you about you, about others. What do they know what's going on?
I think there's a sort of naivety in the universities in general in relation to these kinds of issues. I mean, there have been many issues, some of which are not all in the public domain, but Warwick University, Glasgow University, Birmingham. There's been a number of other universities who've had similar sorts of issues come up. We've heard recently about the case in Sheffield Hallam University. I think that the problem is that that universities aren't really familiar with the politics of this. They've been browbeaten into adopting the IHRA definition by the government and by the lobby. And as a result, people who don't have a good grounding in Palestinian human rights campaigning, when they look at the IHRA, they don't really understand how they're supposed to interpret it, and they interpret it in a way which results in perfectly legal, lawful, not anti-Semitic speech being effectively criminalised. And so there's a kind of naivety there. And when you point this out to people, well, they look at you a little bit strangely. They don't understand that this is actually a lobby campaign, as is well known, really, directed from Israel. I mean, the CST was involved very, very early on with the Israeli government in the process which led to the IHRA. The IHRA didn't come from nowhere. It came from Israel lobby groups putting onto the agenda and having it agreed. And so what you have is a hostile foreign power, the Israeli government, trying to intervene in politics, first in the Labour Party and now in the universities, and indeed in many other places as well. And the weapon of choice, as we said in the report, is the IHRA definition. So the problem is that the universities don't really get that. And until and unless we are able to reverse the IHRA adoption in universities, we will see many more people who are disciplined or thrown from their jobs or denied appointments, etc. And that's the difficulty with this whole process, is that the universities roll over, not necessarily because of an ideological commitment to Zionism, but because they don't really know what they're doing.
And, it's interesting that you say that, because a hostile foreign government intervening in British politics, in British education system and so on via these groups. Imagine if, let's say, the Russians were doing that, for example. It would be a massive nationwide story, international headlines spinning around. But because it's Israel, it's a colonialist ally, if you like, it seems to be totally ignored. In fact, there could even be some cooperation, in fact, from Westminster, as you mentioned. But very briefly, before the show ends, perhaps you could just tell us what you think could or should be done to try and combat against this smear machinery that's going on.
Well, I mean, the unions, the UCU, the University College Union, could do much more than it has done. In some places it's been very good. In the case of Sheffield Hallam recently, it's been very good. And that's one thing. But the other thing is, of course, that many of these organisations, including the Community Security Trust, are charities, and they are supposed to exist for public benefit. And it's clear that in some of their activities, the activities we've been outlining, they're not acting for public benefit. They're acting in the interests of, a hostile foreign power. And it's about time that the Charity Commission started to take note of this. There are many, many pro-Israel groups in this country, hundreds of them, which are charities. And many of them are effectively violating their own charitable charters. And that's something which, in the fullness of time, I hope to see pushback on, and that the Charity Commission is forced into not allowing activities which are, in effect, collaborating with breaches of international law.
Sure. Well, gentlemen, unfortunately, we are out of time for this edition of the programme, but I'm sure we'll have you back very, very soon, Chris and David. We'll see you next time for sure. And hopefully we'll see you at home back joining us on the next edition of Palestine Declassified. Until next time, it's bye for now.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio This is your host, Musa Al-Bahadali, and you are now listening to the program, Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems and other issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. As usual, all of the answers provided in this program are based upon the Holy Quran and upon the narration